is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. Black culture is expansive. It's global. It's influential. It takes place online, on Black Twitter, as it's called, but also in hair salons and at kitchen counters. And somehow, despite regional differences and language barriers, Black culture and the Black experience is often shared. In their new book, Black Futures, author Jenna Wortham and curator Kimberly Drew attempt to chronicle this shared experience. They do this through 500-plus pages of art, essays, stories, interviews, recipes, even memes by Black creators worldwide. Its contributors include Solange Knowles, Nicole Hannah-Jones, Kiese Lehman, and by illustrating what it means to be Black and alive right now, they hope to illuminate what it will mean to be Black and alive in the future. So we're talking to the editors of Black Futures today. Kimberly Drew is a writer, art curator, and the author of This Is What I Know About Art. Kimberly, welcome to 1A.
Thank you so much for having us.
Also with us, Jenna Wortham. She's a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. She's also the co-host of the podcast, Still Processing. Jenna, welcome.
Thank you so much again for having us.
This is a huge book. As I said, over 500 pages. It's incredibly ambitious. Kimberly, I want to hear the story of how you came up with the central concept.
Oh, I love. You know, it's funny. It's actually Jenna's concept first.
Okay,
so first and foremost, I must bow down.
Jenna, carry on.
Well, the book began as, you know, an exchange between Kimberly and I, more or less, right? I reached out to Kimberly over DM and said, hey, let's get lunch. You know, I'd been a tech reporter and just observing the way culture and Black culture was moving and flourishing online through social media. And I felt like there needed to be something that just dealt with that directly, right? We've been talking about Black art and Black culture. We've been talking about social media. And this was 2014, 2015. But there hadn't really been anything monumental that had connected the two in a way that I felt was significant. And I really admired Kimberly because at the time she was running this incredible blog called Black Contemporary Art, which is on Tumblr. And it was just this incredible, you know, art piece, installation, commentary on just the lack of Black artists in cultural institutions. And so I slid into her DMs, as the story goes, and the rest is history.
Kimberly, the book itself is like a piece of art. It's sleek, it's glossy, it catches your eye right away. And you lay out a color scheme inside. It's almost like a map key where the color of a page corresponds with a theme or topic. Can you explain that a little more for us?
Yes, absolutely. We were very fortunate to be able to work in close partnership with the design duo Marcos Key. And in the early stages of the book, they presented three or so different directions for us. And we as a group came to the idea that it should look really rhizomatic, that it should be responsive to the web. And so we tried to make a book that could really encapsulate so much of the things that we were seeing online through that format. And the thematic kind of branches that happened throughout the book were actually inspired by our incredible editor, Chris Jackson, who we love so much.
You know, Jenna, when I started looking through this, I was like, how do you even start to wrap your head around who you want to invite to be part of this project? I mean, where did that start?
That's a great question. And, you know, we definitely, there were so many more people we wanted to include in the book. And that's just a testament to how, you know, abundant of a moment that we're living in. But it really began with Kimberly and I just sharing ideas and images and pieces and essays and just constantly texting each other or emailing each other or going to look at art together and being like, what do you think about this? And what do you think about this? And I think we were really guided by our instincts and our intuition. And so when something kind of sparked our heart space, right, or like got our you know, butterflies in our stomach, we were like, okay, this belongs in the book.
Kimberly, this seems like a project where it'd be very difficult to say, okay, it's finished now. When did you know you'd captured what you wanted to capture for this?
I would like to say a very big shout out to Deadlines. It was really time more than anything else. We were working down to the wire. This project happened over the course of about 5 years, which is wild to think about. But really, our One World team was like, okay, tapping their wrists, like, we got to get this done. And so it came to a really happy end. And of course, it's wild to think about the book coming out in this particular moment. But definitely, we were working up until really this spring, on this book.
Well, let's listen to a part of the introduction to the book now.
This is not an art book. This is not a scholarly journal. This book is a series of guideposts for current and future generations who may be curious about what our generation has been creating during a time defined by social, cultural, economic, and ecological revolution.
Jenna, as you started to collect works for the book, what were some of the common themes you started to see?
Well, we definitely started to, organize the book into chapters because our publishers asked us to. They felt that it might be useful as a guidepost, as a guidepost throughout the book. And we were just organizing the information and realizing that there were themes around memory, there were themes of joy, legacy, and justice. One that we both loved is Black is Still Beautiful. There's so much in the book that deals with beauty and care and caretaking, and that was one that was really important for us as well.
It's interesting in hearing that intro, and you say it's not an art book, it's not a scholarly journal, it's a series of guideposts. Do you see this, Kimberly, as, I don't know, as a historical text in a way?
I love this question. I really hope that this book has an incredible longevity. But I think when we were coming together to write the introduction, we really were focused on creating a book that could appeal to so many people. I think oftentimes we encounter culture in these siloed spaces and institutions and academic spaces. And we really wanted to make something that could be on your mantle, in your bathroom, in the doctor's office, at your granny's house, and you're like rifling through. And so we wanted it to have the softest landing possible, because all too often, I think many of us have encountered texts where we feel like it's going over our head or isn't speaking directly to us.
Jenna, what about for you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when Kimberly and I first came together and were talking about the book, initially I thought, okay, it should just be like a quick one-off thing, like maybe a zine or like a pop-up art show. And it was really Kimberly who was like, this could be a book. This is a book. Kimberly at the time was working more rooted in the art world, in galleries and museums, and was like, this belongs in a gift shop, this belongs in a library, this is something that needs to travel where people will find it in unexpected ways. And so in that sense, yes, absolutely. And I think, I love imagining 50 years in the future, 10 years in the future, where our book is, stashed on someone's shelf or in the back of a closet, and some young person or some older person finds it, who's never heard of it before, and has this whole new experience with it. And that's one of our biggest dreams for the book, that it's going to go into these unexpected places in the future and become this historical archive of what our generation was thinking about and dealing about as we were navigating just an incredible time of, cultural, sociological, ecological revolution.
Kimberly, I'm thinking about the fact that this was a 5-year project, and just over the course of the last year, a lot has happened. 2020 feels like the longest year for a lot of us in our lifetimes. How do you complete a project like this when, just in the space of those 5 years, so much has happened?
I mean, it's as hard as it sounds. We put in a lot of work, and there was a lot of tenderness and a lot of vulnerability and a lot of late night chats where we were like, it's okay. We can put it down now. Some of those things that we feel aren't here are here in one way or another. We have to trust the process. And we also have to trust that either, this project will go into, future iterations, or someone will make a responsive text on the things that they feel like weren't there. But we had to trust that, within the confines that we had, that it was enough, just even for right now. And I think that for, I can speak for myself and say, I think that's one of the greatest victories, was that we just had to sit together and say, okay, we have done our best.
Well, the book is divided into these categories with titles like power, joy, justice, memory. Jenna, how did you come up with this cataloging system, and why was that the right lens through which to tell the story of Black life today?
You know, we struggled with figuring out how to organize all the materials in the book, right? Should it be chronological? Should we pick an end date and, you know, a beginning date and an end date, and just try to list everything that's happened for the period of time that we're working on? You know, it was really kind of an interesting challenge. And our designers were really wonderful in designing this color scheme, which you all spoke of. And I think that was one of the initial impulses around the book as well, that it wouldn't be linear. It wouldn't make sense to try to catalog things chronologically, because that's just often not our experience of things. Things that are happening in 2020 remind us of things that happened in 1820, right? And we're constantly trying to make sense of that and to try to, you know, to pull from the past and to pull from the present to understand kind of the where we're at and where we want to be going. And so thinking about the themes that kind of govern our lives made sense. And of course, this is just a handful of themes that we picked. These are not all encompassing of the Black experience. But as we were looking at the images and the essays, it started to make sense. Okay, these essays and these images and these works are about ownership, right? And how we think about it and how fraught it is in this country as a Black person to think about home ownership or even, you know, agency over your body. And excuse me. The same was true when we started to look at some of the images around memory and how do we remember things. And we're always fighting, what we believe, we're always kind of fighting this ideological battle against trying to remember, right? Because we live in a time where there's just so much information, there's so much content, there's so much happening. You know, our brains are constantly struggling with trying to even hold on to what happened 2 days ago, which can feel like it happened 2 years ago, right? So we wanted to tangle with that in the topic of memory. So it really emerged very organically, but once the concept presented itself to us in the process, it was like, this is how the book will be organized. We'll do it thematically, and we'll make sure that there are connections between the themes as well, so the book can kind of flow in that way.
Tisha emails, I am a teacher, and I'm listening to 1A right now while I work during my planning period, and I cannot tell you how much this conversation has lit me up. I just ordered the book on Amazon. This is very exciting because it affirms Black people on a global scale, and it allows us to be seen. We have to continue to say Black lives matter with tangible artifacts for the present moment. One of these sections is titled Black is Still Beautiful and includes chapters about Black hair, including a nod to Solange's 2016 song, Don't Touch My Hair. There are also pieces on trans visibility, including an essay by writer Raquel Willis. Kimberly, why was it important for you to touch on representation and visibility in these ways?
Ooh, honey, I mean, what is a conversation about Blackness that isn't a conversation about visibility and representation? We had to do it. And we were so lucky, especially to have Raquel, who is like a sister to both of us, who is such a brilliant thinker, pull together this essay that happened as an iterative process and took a few different forms to really speak to this moment, especially online, that was happening where people were better able to determine and affirm their own identities and find a sense of who they were, not only in response to mainstream media images, but in response to a newfound community, a newfound way of having these conversations and dialogues about what it meant to be in the bodies that we find ourselves in.
You know, in looking through the book, Jenna, there was something very grounding about it. I guess that's how I would explain it, because it seems like so much information right now is transient. It's just sort of like, you know, flowing over your Twitter feed, or it's the next website you click on. How did you come away from creating this book? Did you feel, I guess, more grounded personally in Black life right now?
You know, I definitely felt more grounded overall. And I think working on the book was a salve, you know, and as Kimberly mentioned earlier,
we were working on the book up until the spring, and so we were in the middle of the latest round of uprisings in this country around needing to remind people about how much Black life matters and what that actually entails. And it was such a difficult time for so many of us and for a multitude of reasons. And it was almost impossible to think about, right, we have to sit down at our computers remotely, of course, because of the pandemic, and work on this book and finish these edits and go through it line by line by line by line. And Kimberly and I just kept saying, you know, it actually is the most sane thing we can be doing right now. It's actually the most healing thing we can be doing right now, which is just immerse ourselves in these stories of Black resilience, Black sorrow, and Black joy. And we felt comforted. And I think that was a really clarifying moment for both of us, where we understood something about what the impact of this book might be and also how it might be received, you know, which is that grounding experience. And that was just, that was an incredible revelation.
Kimberly, we've got just about a minute here before the break. What about for you? How did it help you, I guess, wrap your head around the Black experience in this moment?
I think so much about a metronome and thinking about the kind of doom scrolling that I think so many of us are finding ourselves in right now. And it was such, I mean, to borrow Jenna from Jenna, it was such a salve to have the metric or the beat of this moment be around this project, and one that we wanted to be a companion to folks who were also going through this moment, instead of just feeling so overwhelmed, which I think is the first stop on the train of 2020.
We're talking to curator Kimberly Drew and author Jenna Wortham about their new book, Black Futures. It's a new collection of art and stories chronicling contemporary Black culture. Coming up, we'll hear about how food fits into the Black experience from one of the book's contributors, Chef Kia Damon. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Gimlet and Resistance. When people all around the world were protesting this summer, you'd hear it over and over. This time is different. But how? In Gimlet's new podcast, Resistance, host Saeed Tijan Thomas Jr. brings us stories from the front lines of the movement for Black lives, told by the generation fighting for change. It's a show about how we can make sure this time really is different. Resistance is out now. Follow and listen for free on Spotify.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
What does it take to really make amends? And how should we navigate our digital spaces? I'm Anoush Zomorodi. Each week on NPR's TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey with TED speakers who help us answer some of life's biggest questions. Join us. Listen now.
Now let's get back to our conversation with Jenna Wortham, staff writer at the New York Times Magazine, and Kimberly Drew, writer and art curator. Their new book is called Black Futures. And I want us to meet one of the book's contributors. Kia Damon is a former head chef and the culinary director at Cherry Bomb Magazine. The New York Times recently named her one of 16 Black chefs changing food in America. Kia, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So in your chapter in the book, you talk about the relationship between food and Blackness. You write, quote, "Just like this book, food has been and will always be a tool for survival," unquote. Explain more about that and about your background as a chef.
For sure. I mean, with the work that I do, I'm always looking towards the people who have done it before me, you know? And I feel like I'm always drawn to the Black Panther Party and the free lunch program, and then Georgia Gilmore and her Club for Nowhere, and, like, you know, getting money for protesters and sit-ins and things like that. And then even way, way further, when we think about Southern food and how enslaved West Africans, like, began to create a whole new type of food, drawing back from where they once came from and trying to use that to stay connected to their roots. And it's food is at the very core of what Black people do and what they're about and how we commune with each other and how we take care of each other spiritually, you know, physically, emotionally, mentally, all of that. When people are hurting, you bring food over. When someone passes away, you have, you know, a repast and everyone's cooking and eating and grieving together. And I find so much solace in that. Oops. I had an alarm going off on my phone.
Oh, no worries, no worries.
You know, I find so much solace in that. And I guess with my own background, I come from a super, super cooking family, very matriarchal family, completely self-taught because my parents were like, girl, we cannot afford school. So I just learned from my family around me and I don't know, just kind of made it up as I went along. And now I am where I am, and I'm pretty grateful for it.
Well, one of the things that's always been interesting to me about, I'll say specifically my family's food culture, is that there aren't recipes. When I'm cooking something and I need to guidance from my mom, I'll call her and say, well, how much of this do I put in? And she says, oh, just until it tastes right. And I'm like, Mom, that is not a direction.
Literally, it's funny to say that I just saw a tweet that had me in tears that was just like, old folks don't use recipes. It's just seasoning and vibes. I was like, yes, it's literally just vibes and just, you know, seeing things and feeling it intuitively, you know? And that's why I'm really honored, honestly, to have this recipe in this book and to talk about my grandmother, because I can take that, you know, intuitive feeling, those vibes, I guess, and put it into an actual recipe and put it into something that can exist and other people can reference, you know, even though my grandmother's no longer here with me. So,
well, the recipe in the book is for fried pig ears. How did you decide on that recipe?
Because I wasn't making no damn chitlins. I was not about to do that. The women in my family make chitlins. They're really, really good at doing that. And I just, I feel like I'm going to get canceled by the community for this, but I'm going to be bold in it. I'm like, chitlins is something that I'm still approaching slowly, you know? Mm-hmm. But I wanted to channel my grandma in that sense that she very country woman, knowing how to use the entire animal, knowing how to utilize everything. And I was like, well, I'm not going to touch a chitlin, but I will learn how to do this instead to try to feel closer to her. And I never got to actually present her with the recipe, but it makes me feel a lot closer to her. And honestly, they're really good. I was really surprised.
Kimberly, why was it important to include someone like Kia to talk about food in Black futures? And this is coming from a person, me, who firmly believes that food is a form of art.
Wow. I mean, how much time do we have for either Jenner or I to go on and on about how much we love Kia?
Oh my God.
And also, shout out to chitlins. I have very visceral memories of cleaning chitlins in my house. So justice for chitlins. We are a pro chitlin group. I just want to get that out there first and foremost. we love chitlins. We wanted to include Kia and then also Pierre Sorau and also some other recipes in the book. Really interested in thinking about those lineages, because oftentimes when we think about traditions and things passed down, we think about, you know, maybe family photos. But in the same way, it's those recipes that has a pinch of this, a pinch of that. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to really think about those connective tissues and the ways that we communicate intergenerationally. And Kia is just so profoundly good at thinking about not only how to be nourished, because I think especially, I mean, Kia is also very young, just for everyone, and not to like be ageist about it, but Kia's a baby. But being really aware of how to be poured into, and then also thinking about what it means to nourish a community is so central to the practices of all the chefs and healers that we have in the book.
Kia, when you think about Black future, and with this understanding that so much of the food tradition you just described is rooted in the past, how do you think about Black future through that lens of food?
Ooh, what a heavy question. What a heavy question. I guess I'll answer the best way I know how. In thinking about Black future and thinking about the past, I mean, it's all very circular. You know, I feel like there's nothing, even when we're creating new ideas and new visions for the future, new visions for food, those things already exist. They've already been thought of. They've already been created and whatever, and we have to look to the past to discover that or to remember that or relearn that. So I guess I just see it as paying respect to those who have done it before us and doing work that constantly reminds us that the work has already been done and that the wheel has already been built and that the references are there. So I guess with the food that I do, I just want to remember the people who did it before me. You know, it's all circular to me. I could think of all kinds of dishes and chitlin this and pig ear that and whatever, but someone has already thought of it. Someone has already, you know, created that. And I just want to pay respect to that and make sure those things are preserved in the future, because Black people exist and we're always going to continue to exist, and our food or some iteration of it is always going to exist. And I just want to make sure that I respect that, you know, and remind people that Black folks be doing it even when we get a race in food, like we're the ones that are doing it, and people need to remember that.
That's Chef Kia Damon. She's one of the contributors to Black Futures. Kia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
There's lots more to talk about with Black Futures editors Kimberly Drew and Jenna Wortham, and we'll do just that right after this break. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR. Where do we go from here? That's one of the big questions that brings you to this podcast. You come here to learn from experts about the latest news on the biggest stories that are impacting our lives and our families during this fateful year. In a year like 2020, you might feel especially grateful for every opportunity to be together, whether that's phone calls or video chats with people you love, or programs like 1A that give us space to connect over ideas and information. You can show your gratitude with a donation to your local NPR station. Just go to donate.npr.org/1A. So if you can afford to make a donation to support this program, it's very easy. Again, you can simply visit donate.npr.org/1A to make a gift to your local station. That's donate.npr.org/1A. And thanks. This is 1A, and we're continuing our conversation about the new book, Black Futures. You know, Jenna, there's such a range in this book. It includes quite a few screenshots of tweets and Facebook posts, a lot of memes, including a chapter by comedian Ziwe Fumudo about the Twitter hashtag Thanksgiving with Black Families. Why was it important to chronicle how Black people exist online?
I'm still vibrating off of Kia's interview. I'm so sorry. She's okay. So wonderful. I'm so glad she was able to join us. And yes, also shout out to Chitlins, because I'm also from Virginia. My dad's from South Carolina, and there were always Chitlins at my house as well. And pig ears and pig feet. But, you know, I think that interview just reminded me, too, of why this book is just so dynamic and so incredible. And there are just so many things we want to hold on to and remember. And yeah, I think tweets were part of that as well, you know. And we were working on the book in 2015 and 2016, which were peak Twitter hashtag years. You know, that's around the time Oscar So White debuted. You know, Thanksgiving with Black Families became a big thing. People were going on and on about Patti LaBelle's pies, mm-hmm. You know. I mean, there was just a lot of Black cultural moments that were happening on Twitter and these celebrations, right? And these platforms that normally don't privilege or prioritize our stories or really even do a lot to preserve them. And so it felt imperative that one of the goals of the book be to really celebrate these, I mean, they almost felt like family reunions, you know, when you would stumble onto a hashtag and just follow along all the jokes and the memes. It didn't feel too dissimilar from being at a cookout or being at a lunchroom table, right? And so that was something we wanted to memorialize as much as we could, that feeling. And not just the good, yummy, warm feeling parts of it, but also the really important activism and awareness that was happening in those hashtags as well. And so one of the collections we have is around Fees Must Fall, which was a group of students in South Africa who were demonstrating and protesting about the inequity of the pricing of schooling for Black South Africans and white South Africans. And if you're a Black South African, it was almost impossible to attend school
affordably, and yet they were constantly being told, well, the way to lift yourself up out of poverty was education. I mean, how does that make sense, right? And so the demonstrations and the protests were just incredible to watch. And I think there's a lot to be learned from how they organized online and how they documented their struggles. And it felt like, again, right, you know, keeping with that circular theme that Kia mentioned, we are doing it everywhere. And we are able to learn from each other. And every new idea that we have and new thought that we have is probably already in practice by one of our peers, right? And so just to sort of archive that and memorialize it so we can continue to remember and learn from each other.
Well, a member of the 1A Text Club wrote in and says, I'm a huge fan of both Jenna's and Kimberly's work and can't wait to get my hands on the book. What does Kimberly, coming from the art world, think of the future Black cultural representation in art spaces? Museums are often exploitative of Black cultures. Is she hopeful that things will change?
Well, 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 what an interesting question to pose during a global health pandemic. I think what is most important when talking about cultural institutions in this moment is also talking about the ways in which these institutions are so hit and impacted, and therefore the artists, the staff members from every point of the hierarchy are impacted by this moment where museums are finding themselves really struggling to stay afloat. And so I think it's so important for us to think about institutions like the Studio Museum, the institutions like the Blacksonian, as we call it in DC, institutions like the Underground Museum in Los Angeles, institutions like the Charles Wright Museum, and thinking about how we can rally our support around these institutions, especially institutions that are founded with the principle of supporting Black artists. I think there's a larger conversation to be had about the impact of institutions, the history of colonialism. All those things are completely valid and true. But I think at this venue and at this juncture, it's so important for us to remember that we have the power to continue to support these institutions, that therefore then to continue to preserve, conserve, and display works by artists who are African of African descent.
We also got this email from Jen who says, could you ask the writers to consider doing a book on 2020? I feel like their unique approach would give us a book that would help us have a history of this crazy year in a way that could help future generations. Now, Jen, I know you just finished this one, but any thoughts about specifically trying to capture this year?
I think one book would not be enough to capture 2020. I think that 2020 would need like a 10-part miniseries on ESPN. Like, it needs... I don't even know if we'll be able to process and dissect 2020 and 2021. I think that is a big undertaking. But I think for now, you know, Kimberly and I are just really focused on, you know, what we poured into Black Futures and how much of it is so resonant for 2020, even though, you know, we put it to bed midway through. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's an essay in the book by writer Doreen St. Felix called June Jordan's Vision of a Black Future, and it's about a futuristic city planning project dreamed up by the late poet June Jordan. And that essay, paired with the title of the book, Black Futures, really brings images of Afrofuturism to mind. You know, at the end of this process, Jenna, how are you thinking about the future for Black people?
Oh my gosh. I am thinking so expansively, and for all that's happened, you know, I still feel optimistic. I still feel, you know, rooted in possibility. I still feel expansive. And I know that there are just so many possibilities and there's so many versions of the world we want to create that are still out there. So I'm just leaning into it and just taking it all in.
Kimberly, what about for you?
I am also optimistic. I was just thinking so much about Jasmine Johnson's essay in the book about the Optimistic Challenge dance, which was, I think, started either by Chance the Rapper or Jay Versace, Origin Points Unknown. And thinking about that being like the truest, most ultimate challenge, where it's like, yes, of course, it's this dance challenge, but also it's this challenge to remain optimistic. And I think that for us is the true, I mean, I think that's one of the greatest responsibilities of being Black,
also is remaining optimistic. And, you know, it's that Afrofuturist principle that's founded in phrases like we shall overcome. And so I feel that very much. And I hope that anyone who encounters the book, whether it be through an online link, the physical book, the audio book, or this interview, thank you so much for having us, is that they understand that we all have the agency to record. We all have the agency to revere ourselves, to regard ourselves, and to understand that our stories are worth being remembered, worth being told, and worth being celebrated.
That's Kimberly Drew. She's an art curator and writer. Also with us, Jenna Wortham, a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and co-host of the Still Processing podcast. They're the editors of the new book, Black Futures. It's a collection of essays, art, and more on contemporary Black culture, and it's available now. Thanks to you both for joining us. This conversation was produced by Arfi Getty, and our podcast is produced by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks so much for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.